that a dark lantern?" I asked, fascinated. "Aye, it is," young Ian said importantly. "You keep the slide shut until we see the signal out at sea." He reached for the lantern. "Here, give it me. I'll take it. I ken the signal." Mr. Willoughby merely shook his head, pulling the lantern out of young Ian's grasp. "Too tall, too young," he said. "Say me, say so," he added, as though that settled the matter once and for all.
"What?" young Ian was indignant. "What do you mean, too tall and too young, you wee—"
"He means," said a level voice behind us, "that whoever's holding the lantern is a bonny target should we have visitors. Mr. Willoughby kindly takes the risk of it because he's the smallest man among us. You're tall enough to see against the sky, wee Ian, and young enough to have nae sense yet. Stay out of the way, aye?"
Jamie gave his nephew a light cuff over the ear and passed by to kneel on the rocks by Mr. Willoughby. He said something low-voiced in Chinese, and there was a ghost of a laugh from the Chinaman. Mr. Willoughby opened the side of the lantern, holding it conveniently to Jamie's cupped hands. A sharp click repeated twice, and I caught the flicker of sparks struck from a flint. It was a wild piece of coast.
Not surprising. Most of Scotland's coast was wild and rocky, and I wondered how and where the French ship would anchor. There was no natural bay, only a curving of the coastline behind a jutting cliff that sheltered this spot from observation from the road. Dark as it was, I could see the white lines of the surf purling in across the small half-moon beach. No smooth tourist beach, this. Small pockets of sand lay ruffled and churned between heaps of seaweed and pebbles and juts of rock. Not an easy footing for men carrying casks, but convenient to the crevices in the surrounding rocks, where the casks could be hidden. Another black figure loomed up suddenly beside me.
"Everyone settled, sir," it said softly. "Up in the rocks."
"Good, Dewey."
A sudden flare lit Jamie's profile, intent on the newly caught wick. He held his breath as the flame steadied and grew, taking up oil from the lantern's reservoir, then let it out with a sigh as he gently closed the metal slide.
"Fine, then," he said, standing up.
He glanced up at the cliff to the south, observing the stars over it, and said,
"Nearly 9 o'clock. They'll be in soon. Mind you, Dewey, no one's to move till I call out, aye?"
"Aye, sir."
The casual tone of the answer made it apparent that this was a customary exchange, and Joey was plainly surprised when Jamie gripped his arm. "Be sure of it," Jamie said. "Tell them all again. No one moves till I give the word."
"Aye, sir," Joey said again,
but this time with more respect. He faded back into the night, making no sound on the rocks.
"Is something wrong?" I asked, pitching my voice barely loud enough to be heard over the breakers.
Though the beach and cliffs were evidently deserted, the dark setting and the secretive conduct of my companions compelled caution. Jamie shook his head briefly. He'd been right about young Ian, I thought. His own dark silhouette was clear against the paler black of the sky behind him.
"I dinna ken."
He hesitated for a moment, then said,
"Tell me, Sassenach, d'ye smell anything?"
Surprised, I obligingly took a deep sniff, held it for a moment, and let it out. I smelled any number of things, including rotted seaweed, the thick smell of burning oil from the dark lantern, and the pungent body odour of young Ian standing close beside me, sweating with a mix of excitement and fear.
"Nothing odd, I don't think," I said. "Do you?"
The silhouette's shoulders rose and dropped in a shrug.
"Not now. A moment ago I could have sworn I smelt gunpowder."
"I didn't smell anything,"
young Ian said. His voice broke from excitement, and he hastily cleared his throat, embarrassed.
"Willie MacLeod and Alec Hay searched the rocks. They didn't find any sign of excisemen."
"Aye, well."
Jamie's voice sounded uneasy. He turned to young Ian, grasping him by the shoulder.
"Ian, you're to take charge of your auntie now. The two of you get back to the gorse bushes there. Keep well away from the wagon. If anything should happen...
The beginnings of young Ian's protests were cut off, apparently by tightening of Jamie's hand, for the boy jerked back with a small grunt, rubbing his shoulder.
If anything should happen, Jamie continued with emphasis, you're to take your auntie and go straight home to Lallybroch. Dinna linger.
But, I said, Uncle,
young Ian said, do it, said Jamie, in tones of steel, and turned aside. The discussion concluded. Young Ian was grim on the trip up the cliff trail, but he did as he was told, dutifully escorting me some distance past the gorse bushes and finding a small promontory where we might see out some way over the water.
"We can see from here," he whispered unnecessarily.
We could indeed. The rocks fell away in a shallow bowl beneath us, a broken cup filled with darkness, the light of the water spilling from the broken edge where the sea hissed in. Once I caught a tiny movement as a metal buckle caught the faint light, but for the most part the 10 men below were completely invisible. I squinted, trying to pick out the location of Mr. Willoughby with his lantern, but saw no sign of light, and concluded that he must be standing behind the lantern, shielding it from sight from the cliff. Young Ian stiffened suddenly next to me.
"Someone's coming," he whispered. "Quick, get behind me!"
Stepping courageously out in front of me, he plunged a hand under his shirt into the band of his breeches and withdrew a pistol. Dark as it was, I could see the faint gleam of starlight along the barrel. He braced himself, peering into the dark, slightly hunched over the gun with both hands clamped on the weapon.
"Don't shoot, for God's sake!" I hissed in his ear.
I didn't dare grab his arm for fear of setting off the pistol, but was terrified lest he make any noise that might attract attention to the men below.
"I'd be obliged if you'd heed your auntie, Ian," came Jamie's soft, ironic tones from the blackness below the cliff edge. "I'd as soon not have ye blow my head off, aye?"
Ian lowered the pistol, shoulders slumping with what might have been a sigh either of relief or disappointment. The gorse bushes quivered, and then Jamie was before us, brushing gorse prickles from the sleeve of his coat.
"Did no one tell you not to come armed?"
Jamie's voice was mild, with no more than a note of academic interest.
"It's a hanging offence to draw a weapon against an officer of the King's Customs," he explained, turning to me. "None of the men are armed, even with so much as a fish knife in case they're taken."
"Aye, well, Fergus said they wouldna hang me because my beard's not grown yet," Ian said awkwardly. "I'd only be transported," he said.
There was a soft hiss as Jamie drew in his breath through his teeth in exasperation.
"Oh, aye, and I'm sure your mother will be very pleased to hear you've been shipped off to the colonies, even if Fergus was right."
He put out his hand.
"Give me that, fool. Where'd you get it anyway?"
he asked, turning the pistol over in his hand.
"Already primed, too.
I knew I smelt gunpowder. Lucky you didn't blow your cock off carrying it in your breeches."
Before young Ian could answer, I interrupted, pointing out to sea.
"Look!"
The French ship was little more than a blot on the face of the sea, but its sails shone pale in the glimmer of starlight. A two-masted ketch, it glided slowly past the cliff and stood off, silent as one of the scattered clouds behind it. Jamie wasn't watching the ship, but looking downward toward a point where the rock face broke in a tumble of boulders just above the sand. Looking where he was looking, I could just make out a tiny prickle of light. Mr. Willoughby with the lantern. There was a brief flash of light that glistened across the wet rocks and was gone. Young Ian's hand was tense on my arm. We waited, breaths held, to the count of 30. Ian's hand squeezed my arm just as another flash lit the foam on the sand. "What was that?" I said.
"What?"
Jamie wasn't looking at me, but out at the ship. On the shore. When the light flashed, I thought I saw something half buried in the sand. It looked like... The third flash came, And a moment later an answering light shone from the ship, a blue lantern, an eerie dot that hung from the mast, doubling itself in reflection in the dark water below. I forgot the glimpse of what appeared to be a rumpled heap of clothing carelessly buried in the sand in the excitement of watching the ship. Some movement was evident now, and a faint splash reached our ears as something was thrown over the side.
"The tide's coming in," Jamie muttered in my ear. "The anchor's float. The current will carry them ashore in a few minutes."
That solved the problem of the ship's anchorage. It didn't need one. But how, then, was the payment made? I was about to ask when there was a sudden shout and all hell broke loose below. Jamie thrust his way at once through the gorse bushes, followed in short order by me and young Ian. Little could be seen distinctly, but there was a considerable turmoil taking place on the sandy beach. I caught the words, "Halt in the King's name," and my blood froze.
"Excisemen?"
Young Ian had caught it too. Jamie said something crude in Gaelic, then threw back his head and shouted himself, his voice carrying easily across the beach below.
"Erican Ilia," he bellowed. "Suas ambieridin shaikiv."
Then he turned to young Ian and me.
"Go,"
he said. The noise suddenly increased as the clatter of falling rocks joined the shouting. Suddenly a dark figure shot out of the gorse by my feet and made off through the dark at high speed. Another followed a few feet away. A high-pitched scream came from the dark below, high enough to be heard over the other noises.
"That's Willoughby," young Ian exclaimed. "They've got him."
Ignoring Jamie's order to go, we both crowded forward to peer through the screen of gorse. The dark lantern had fallen a tilt, and the slide had come open, shooting a beam of light like a spotlight over the beach, where the shallow graves in which the customs men had buried themselves gaped in the sand. Black figures swayed and struggled and shouted through the wet heaps of seaweed. A dim glow of light around the lantern was sufficient to show two figures clasped together, the smaller kicking wildly as it was lifted off its feet.
"I'll get him!"
Young Ian sprang forward, only to be pulled up with a jerk as Jamie caught him by the collar.
"Do as you're told, and see my wife safe."
Gasping for breath, young Ian turned to me, but I wasn't going anywhere, and set my feet firmly in the dirt, resisting his tug on my arm. Ignoring us both, Jamie turned and ran along the cliff top, stopping several yards away. I could see him clearly in silhouette against the sky as he dropped to one knee and readied the pistol, bracing it on his forearm to sight downward. The sound of the shot was no more than a small cracking noise lost amid the tumult. The result of it, though, was spectacular. The lantern exploded in a shower of burning oil, abruptly darkening the beach and silencing the shouting. The silence was broken within seconds by a howl of mingled pain and indignation. My eyes, momentarily blinded by the flash of the lantern, adapted quickly, and I saw another glow, the light of several small flames which seemed to be moving erratically up and down. As my night vision cleared, I saw that the flames rose from the coat sleeve of a man who was dancing up and down as he howled, beating ineffectually at the fire started by the burning oil that had splashed him. The gorse bushes quivered violently as Jamie plunged over the cliffside and was lost to view below.
"Jamie!"
Roused by my cry, young Ian yanked harder, pulling me half off my feet and forcibly dragging me away from the cliff.
"Come on, Auntie, they'll be up here next thing."
This was undeniably true. I could hear the shouts on the beach coming closer as the men swarmed up the rocks. I picked up my skirts and went, following the boy as fast as we could go through the rough marrow grass of the cliff top. I didn't know where we were going, but young Ian seemed to. He had taken off his coat, and the white of his shirt was easily visible before me, floating like a ghost through the thickets of alder and birch that grew farther inland.
"Where are we?"
I panted, coming up alongside him when he slowed at the bank of a tiny stream.
"The road to Arbroath's just ahead," he said.
He was breathing heavily, and a dark smudge of mud showed down the side of his shirt.
"It'll be easier going in a moment. Are you all right, Auntie? Shall I carry you across?"
I politely declined this gallant offer, privately noting that I undoubtedly weighed as much as he did. I took off my shoes and stockings and splashed my way knee-deep across the streamlet, feeling icy mud well up between my toes. I was shivering violently when I emerged and did accept Ian's offer of his coat. Excited as he was and heated by the exercise, he was clearly in no need of it. I was chilled, not only by the water and the cold November wind, but by fear of what might be happening behind us. We emerged panting onto the road, the wind blowing cold in our faces. My nose and lips were numb in no time, and my hair blew loose behind me, heavy on my neck. It's an ill wind that blows nobody good, though. It carried the sound of voices to us moments before we would have walked into them.
"Any signal from the cliff?" a deep male voice asked.
Ian stopped so abruptly in his tracks that I bumped into him.
"Not yet," came the reply. "I thought I heard a bit of shouting that way, but then the wind turned." "Well, get up that tree again then, heavy arse," the first voice said impatiently. "If any of the whoreson's get past the beach, we'll nobble 'em here. Better us get the head money than the buggers on the beach."
"It's cold," grumbled the second voice.
"Out in the open where the wind gnaws your bones. Wish we'd drawn the watch at the abbey. At least it would be warm there."
Young Ian's hand was clutching my upper arm tight enough to leave bruises. I pulled, trying to loosen his grip, but he paid no attention.
"Aye, but less chance of catching a big fish," the first voice said. "Ah, and what I might do with £50. "Oh, right," said the second voice, resigned. "Though how we're to see red hair in the dark, I've no notion. Just lay 'em by the heels, Oakey. We'll look at their heads later."
Young Ian was finally roused from his trance by my tugging and stumbled after me off the road and into the bushes. "What do they mean by the watch at the abbey?" I demanded as soon as I thought we were out of earshot of the watchers on the road. "Do you know?" Young Ian's dark thatch bobbed up and down.
"I think so, Auntie. It must be our Broth Abbey. That's the meeting point, eh?"
"Meeting point? If something should go wrong," he explained, "then it's every man for himself, all to meet at the Abbey as soon as they can." "Well, it couldn't go more wrong," I observed. "What was it your uncle shouted when the customs men popped up?"
Young Ian had half turned to listen for pursuit from the road. Now the pale oval of his face turned back to me.
"Oh," he said, "up, lads, over the cliff and run."
"Sound advice," I said dryly. "So if they followed it, most of the men may have gotten away."
"Except Uncle Jimmy and Mr. Willoughby."
Young Ian was running one hand nervously through his hair. It reminded me forcibly of Jamie, and I wished he would stop.
"Yes,"
I took a deep breath.
"Well, there's nothing we can do about them just now. The other men, though, if they're headed for the Abbey..."
"Aye,"
he broke in. "That's what I was trying to decide. Ought I do as Uncle Jimmy said and take you to Lallybroch? Or had I best try to get to the Abbey quick and warn the others as they come?"
"Get to the Abbey," I said, "as fast as you can."
"Well, but I shouldn't like to leave you out here by yourself, Auntie, and Uncle Jimmy said..."
"There's a time to follow orders, young Ian, and a time to think for yourself," I said firmly, tactfully ignoring the fact that I was, in fact, doing the thinking for him.
"Does this road lead to the Abbey?"
"Aye, it does. No more than a mile and a quarter." Already he was shifting to and fro on the balls of his feet, eager to be gone.
"Good. You cut round the road and head for the Abbey. I'll walk straight along the road and see if I can distract the excisemen until you're safely past. I'll meet you at the Abbey." "Oh, wait! You'd best take your coat."
I surrendered the coat reluctantly. Besides being loath to part with its warmth, it felt like giving up my last link with a friendly human presence. Once young Ian was away, I would be completely alone in the cold dark of the Scottish night.
"Ian..."
I held his arm to keep him a moment longer.
"Aye." "Be careful, won't you?"
On impulse, I stood on tiptoe and kissed his cold cheek. I was near enough to see his brows arch in surprise. He smiled, and then he was gone, an alder branch snapping back into place behind him. It was very cold. The only sounds were the whish of the wind through the bushes and the distant murmur of the surf. I pulled the woolen shawl tightly round my shoulders, shivering, and headed back toward the road. Ought I to make a noise? I wondered. If not, I might be attacked without warning, since the waiting men might hear my footsteps but couldn't see that I wasn't an escaping smuggler. On the other hand, if I strolled through singing a jaunty tune to indicate that I was a harmless woman, they might just lie hidden in silence, not wanting to give away their presence. And giving away their presence was exactly what I had in mind. I bent and picked up a rock from the side of the road. Then, feeling even colder than before, I stepped out onto the road and walked straight on, without a word. Chapter 31 Smuggler's Moon. The wind was high enough to keep the trees and bushes in a constant stir, masking the sound of my footsteps on the road, and those of anyone who might be stalking me too. Less than a fortnight past the Feast of Samhain, it was a sort of wild night that made one easily believe that the spirits and evil might well be abroad. It wasn't a spirit that grabbed me suddenly from behind, hand clamped tight across my mouth. Had I not been prepared for just such an eventuality, I would have been startled senseless. As it was, my heart gave a great leap, and I jerked convulsively in my captor's grasp. He had grabbed me from the left, pinning my left arm tight against my side, his right hand over my mouth. My right arm was free, though. I drove the heel of my shoe into his kneecap, buckling his leg, and then, taking advantage of his momentary stagger, leaned forward and smashed backward at his head with the rock in my hand. It was of necessity a glancing blow, but it struck hard enough that he grunted with surprise and his grip loosened. I kicked and squirmed, and as his hand slipped across my mouth, I got my teeth onto a finger and bit down as hard as I could. The maxillary muscles run from the sagittal crest at the top of the skull to an insertion on the mandible, I thought, dimly recalling the description from Gray's Anatomy. This gives the jaw and teeth considerable crushing power. In fact, the average human jaw is capable of exerting over 300 pounds of force. I didn't know whether I was bettering the average, but I was undeniably having an effect. My assailant was thrashing frantically to and fro in a futile effort to dislodge the death grip I had on his finger. His hold on my arm had loosened in the struggle, and he was forced to lower me. As soon as my feet touched the dirt once more, I let go of his hand, whirled about, and gave him as hearty a root in the stones with my knee as I could manage, given my skirts. Kicking men in the testicles is vastly overrated as a means of defence. That is to say, it does work, and spectacularly well. But it's a more difficult manoeuvre to carry out than one might think, particularly when one is wearing heavy skirts. Men are extremely careful of those particular appendages, and thoroughly wary of any attempt on them. In this case, though, my attacker was off guard, his legs wide apart to keep his balance, and I caught him fairly. He made a hideous wheezing noise like a strangled rabbit, and doubled up in the roadway. "Is that you, Sassenach?" The words were hissed out of the darkness to my left. I leapt like a startled gazelle and uttered an involuntary scream. For the second time, within as many minutes, a hand clapped itself over my mouth. "For God's sake, Sassenach," Jamie muttered in my ear. "It's me." I didn't bite him, though I was strongly tempted to. "I know," I said, through my teeth when he released me. "Who's the other fellow that grabbed me, though?"
"Fergus, I expect."
The amorphous dark shape moved away a few feet and seemed to be prodding another shape that lay on the road, moaning faintly.
"Is that you, Fergus?" he whispered.
Receiving a sort of choked noise in response, he bent and hauled the second shape to its feet.
"Don't talk," I urged them in a whisper. "There are excisemen just ahead.
"Is that so?" said Jamie in a normal voice. "They're not very curious about the noise we're making, are they?"
He paused, as though waiting for an answer. But no sound came but the low keening of the wind through the alders. He laid a hand on my arm and shouted into the night,
"MacLeod, Rayburn!"
"Aye, Roy,"
said a mildly testy voice in the shrubbery. "We're here. Innes too, and Meldrum, is it?"
"Aye, that's me."
Shuffling and talking in low voices, more shapes emerged from the bushes and trees. 4, 5, 6, Jamie counted. "Where are he's and the Gordons?"
"I saw he's going to the water,"
one of the shapes volunteered. "He'll have gone a wall round the point, like the Gordons and Kennedy did too.
I didn't hear as though they'd been taken."
"Well enough," Jamie said. "Now then, Sassenach, what's this about, excisemen?"
Given the non-appearance of Oakey and his companion, I was beginning to feel rather foolish, but I recounted what Ian and I had heard.
"Aye."
Jamie sounded interested.
"Can you stand yet, Fergus?" "You can. Good lad. Well then, perhaps we'll have a look. Meldrum, have you a flint about you?"
A few moments later, a small torch struggling to stay alight in his hand, he strode down the road and around the bend. The smugglers and I waited in tense silence, ready either to run or to rush to his assistance, but there were no noises of ambush. After what seemed like an eternity, Jamie's voice floated back along the road.
"Come along, then," he said,
sounding calm and collected. He was standing in the middle of the road, near a large alder. The torchlight fell round him in a flickering circle, and at first I saw nothing but Jamie. Then there was a gasp from the man beside me, and a choked sound of horror from another. Another face appeared, dimly lit, hanging in the air just behind Jamie's left shoulder. A horrible, congested face, black in the torchlight that robbed everything of colour, with bulging eyes and tongue protruding. The hair, fair as dry straw, rose, stirring in the wind. I felt a fresh scream rise in my throat and choked it off.
"You were right, Sassenach," Jamie said. "There was an exciseman."
He tossed something to the ground, where it landed with a small plop.
"A warrant," he said, nodding toward the object. "His name was Thomas Oakey. Will any of you ken him?"
"Not like he is now," a voice muttered behind me. "Christ, his mither wouldn't ken him."
There was a general mutter of negation with a nervous shuffling of feet. Clearly everyone was as anxious to get away from the place as I was.
"All right, then." Jamie stopped the retreat with a jerk of his head. "The cargo's lost, so there'll be no shares, aye? Will anyone need money for the present?"
He reached for his pocket.
"I can provide enough to live on for a bit, for I doubt we'll be working the coast for a time."
One or two of the men reluctantly advanced within clear sight of the thing hanging from the tree to receive their money, but the rest of the smugglers melted quietly away into the night. Within a few minutes, only Fergus, still white but standing on his own, Jamie and I were left.
"Jesu,"
Fergus whispered, looking up at the hanged man. "Who will have done it?"
"I did, or so I expect the tale will be told, aye."
Jamie gazed upward, his face harsh in the sputtering torchlight.
"We'll tarry no longer, shall we?"
"What about Ian?" I said, suddenly remembering the boy. "He went to the Abbey to warn you."
"He did."
Jamie's voice sharpened.
"I came from that direction and didn't I meet him. Which way did he go, Sassenach?"
"That way,"
I said, pointing. Fergus made a small sound that might have been laughter.
"The Abbey's the other way,"
Jamie said, sounding amused.
"Come on, then.
We'll catch him up when he realises his mistake and comes back."
"Wait,"
said Fergus, holding up his hand. There was a cautious rustling in the shrubbery, and young Ian's voice said,
"Uncle Jimmy."
"Aye, Ian," his uncle said dryly. "It's me."
The boy emerged from the bushes, leaves stuck in his hair, eyes wide with excitement.
"I saw the light and thought I must come back to see that Auntie Clare was all right,"
he explained. "Uncle Jimmy, you mustn't linger about with your torch. There are excisemen about."
Jamie put an arm about his nephew's shoulders and turned him before he should notice the thing hanging from the alder tree.
"Dinna trouble yourself, Ian," he said evenly. "They've gone."
Swinging the torch through the wet shrubbery, he extinguished it with a hiss.
"Let's go," he said,
his voice calm in the dark.
"Mr. Willoughby's down the road wi' the horses. We'll be in the Highlands by dawn."
This ends Disc 16. Voyager, Disc 17.
Part 7. Home Again. Chapter 32. The Prodigal's Return. It was a four-day journey on horseback to Lallybroch from Arbroath, and there was little conversation for most of it. Both young Ian and Jamie were preoccupied, presumably for different reasons. For myself, I was kept busy wondering, not only about the recent past, but about the immediate future. Ian must have told Jamie's sister Jenny about me. How would she take my reappearance? Jenny Murray had been the nearest thing I had ever had to a sister, and by far the closest woman friend of my life. Owing to circumstance, most of my close friends in the last 15 years had been men. There were no other female doctors, and the natural gulf between nursing staff and medical staff prevented more than casual acquaintance with other women working at the hospital. As for the women in Frank's circle, the departmental secretaries and university wives... More than any of that, though, was the knowledge that of all the people in the world, Jenny was the one who might love Jamie Fraser as much, if not more, than I did. I was eager to see Jenny again, but couldn't help wondering how she would take the story of my supposed escape to France and my apparent desertion of her brother. The horses had to follow each other in single file down the narrow track. My own bay slowed obligingly as Jamie's chestnut paused, then turned aside at his urging into a clearing half hidden by an overhang of alder branches. A grey stone cliff rose up at the edge of the clearing, its cracks and bumps and ridges so furred with moss and lichen that it looked like the face of an ancient man, all spotted with whiskers and freckled with warts. Young Ian slid down from his pony with a sigh of relief. We'd been in the saddle since dawn. "Oof," he said, frankly rubbing his backside. "I've gone all numb." "So have I," I said, doing the same. "I suppose it's better than being saddle sore, though." Unaccustomed to riding for long stretches, both young Ian and I had suffered considerably during the first 2 days of the journey. In fact, too stiff to dismount by myself the first night, I had had to be ignominiously hoisted off my horse and carried into the inn by Jamie, much to his amusement.
"How does Uncle Jamie do it?" Ian asked me. "His arse must be made of leather."
"Not to look at," I replied absently.
"Where's he gone, though?"
The chestnut, already hobbled, was nibbling at the grass under an oak to one side of the clearing, but of Jamie himself there was no sign. Young Ian and I looked blankly at each other. I shrugged and went over to the cliff face where a trickle of water ran down the rock. I cupped my hands beneath it and drank, grateful for the cold liquid sliding down my dry throat in spite of the autumn air that reddened my cheeks and numbed my nose. This tiny glen clearing, invisible from the road, was characteristic of most of the Highland scenery, I thought. Deceptively barren and severe, the crags and moors were full of secrets. If you didn't know where you were going, you could walk within inches of a deer, a grouse, or a hiding man, and never know it. Small wonder that many of those who were taken to the heather after Culloden had managed to escape, their knowledge of the hidden places making them invisible to the blind eyes and clumsy feet of the pursuing English. Thirst slaked, I turned from the cliff face and nearly ran into Jamie, who had appeared as though sprung out of the earth by magic. He was putting his tinderbox back into the pocket of his coat, and the faint smell of smoke clung to his coat. He dropped a small burnt stick to the grass and ground it to dust with his foot.
"Where did you come from?" I said, blinking at this apparition. "And where have you been?"
"There's a wee cave just there," he explained, jerking a thumb behind him. "I only wanted to see whether anyone's been in it."
"Have they?"
Looking closely, I could see the edge of the outcrop that concealed the cave's entrance. Blending as it did with the other deep cracks in the rock face, it wouldn't be visible unless you were deliberately looking for it.
"Aye, they have," he said.
His brows were slightly furrowed, not in worry, but as though he were thinking about something.
"There's charcoal mixed with the earth. Someone's had a fire there."
"Who do you think it was?"
I asked. I stuck my head around the outcrop but saw nothing but a narrow bar of darkness, a small rift in the face of the mountain. It looked thoroughly uninviting. I wondered whether any of his smuggling connections might have traced him all the way from the coast to Lallybroch. Was he worried about pursuit or an ambush? Despite myself, I looked over my shoulder but saw nothing but the alders, dry leaves rustling in the autumn breeze.
"I dinna ken," he said absently. "A hunter, I suppose. There are grouse bones scattered about, too."
Jamie didn't seem perturbed by the unknown person's possible identity, and I relaxed, the feeling of security engendered by the Highlands wrapping itself about me once more. Both Edinburgh and the Smuggler's Cove seemed a long way away. Young Ian, fascinated by the revelation of the invisible cave, had disappeared through the crevice. Now he reappeared, brushing a cobweb out of his hair.
"Is this like Clooney's cage, Uncle?" he asked, eyes bright.
"None so big, Ian," Jamie answered with a smile. "Poor Clooney would scarce fit through the entrance of this one. He was a stout big fellow forby, nearly twice my girth."
He touched his chest ruefully where a button had been torn loose by squeezing through the narrow entrance.
"What's Clooney's cage?" I asked, shaking the last drops of icy water from my hands and thrusting them under my armpits to thaw out.
"Oh, that's Clooney Macpherson," Jamie replied.
He bent his head and splashed the chilly water up into his face. Lifting his head, he blinked the sparkling drops from his lashes and smiled at me.
"A very ingenious man, Clooney. The English burnt his house and pulled down the foundation, but Clooney himself escaped. He built himself a wee snuggery in a nearby cavern and sealed over the entrance with willow branches all woven together and chinked with mud. Folks said you could stand 3 feet away and no notion that the cave was there, save the smell of the smoke from Clooney's pipe.
Prince Charles stayed there too for a bit when he was hunted by the English,"
young Ian informed me.
"Clooney hid him for days. The English bastards hunted high and low, but never found his highness. Or Clooney either," he concluded with considerable satisfaction.
"Come here and wash yourself, Ian,"
Jamie said with a hint of sharpness that made young Ian blink.
"You canna fish your parents covered with filth."
Ian sighed, but obediently bent his head over the trickle of water, sputtering and gasping as he splashed his face, which, while not strictly speaking filthy, undeniably bore one or two small stains of travel. I turned to Jamie, who stood watching his nephew's ablutions with an air of abstraction. Did he look ahead, I wondered, to what promised to be an awkward meeting at Lallybroch, or back to Edinburgh, with the smouldering remains of his print shop and the dead man in the basement of the brothel? Or back further still, to Charles Edward Stuart and the days of the Rising?
"What do you tell your nieces and nephews about him?"
I asked quietly, under the noise of Ian's snorting.
"About Charles?"
Jamie's gaze sharpened and focused on me. I had been right then. His eyes warmed slightly, and the hint of a smile acknowledged the success of my mind-reading. But then both warmth and smile disappeared.
"I never speak of him," he said,
just as quietly, and turned away to catch the horses. 3 hours later, we came through the last of the wind-swept passes and out onto the final slope that led down to Lullibroch. Jamie, in the lead, drew up his horse and waited for me and young Ian to come up beside him.
"There it is," he said.
He glanced at me, smiling, one eyebrow raised.
"Much changed, is it?"
I shook my head, rapt. From this distance, the house seemed completely unchanged. Built of white harled stone, its three stories gleamed immaculately amid its cluster of shabby outbuildings and the spread of stone-diked brown fields. On the small rise behind the house stood the remains of the ancient broch, the circular stone tower that gave the place its name. On closer inspection, I could see that the outbuildings had changed a bit. Jamie had told me that the English soldiery had burned the dovecot and the chapel the year after Culloden, and I could see the gaps where they had been. A space where the wall of the kale yard had been broken through had been repaired with stone of a different colour, and a new shed built of stone and scrap lumber was evidently serving as a dovecot, judging from the row of plump-feathered bodies lined up on the roof tree enjoying the late autumn sun. The rose briar, planted by Jamie's mother, Ellen, had grown up into a great sprawling tangle latticed to the wall of the house, only now losing the last of its leaves. A plume of smoke rose from the western chimney, carrying away toward the south on the wind from the sea. I had a sudden vision of the fire in the hearth of the sitting room, its light rosy on Jenny's clear-cut face in the evening as she sat in her chair, reading aloud from a novel or book of poems, while Jamie and Ian sat absorbed in a game of chess, listening with half an ear. How many evenings had we spent that way, the children upstairs in their beds, and me, sitting at the Rosewood secretary, writing down receipts for medicines or doing some of the interminable domestic mending. "Will we live here again, do you think?" I asked Jamie, careful to keep any trace of longing from my voice. More than any other place, the house at Lullibroch had been home to me. But that had been a long time ago, and any number of things had changed since then. He paused for a long minute, considering. Finally, he shook his head, gathering up the reins in his hand.
"I canna say, Sassenach," he said. "It would be pleasant, but I dinna ken how things may be, aye."
There was a small frown on his face as he looked down at the house.
"It's all right. If we live in Edinburgh, or even in France, it's all right, Jamie."
I looked up into his face and touched his hand in reassurance.
"As long as we're together."
The faint look of worry lifted momentarily, lightening his features. He took my hand, raised it to his lips, and kissed it gently.
"I dinna mind much else myself, Sassenach, so long as you'll stay by me."
We sat gazing into each other's eyes until a loud, self-conscious cough from behind alerted us to young Ian's presence. Scrupulously careful of our privacy, he had been embarrassingly circumspect on the trip from Edinburgh, crashing off through the heather to a great distance when we camped, and taking remarkable pains so as not, inadvertently, to surprise us in an indiscreet embrace. Jamie grinned and squeezed my hand before letting it go and turning to his nephew.
"Almost there, Ian,"
he said, as the boy negotiated his pony up beside us.
"We'll be there before supper if it doesn't rain,"
he added, squinting under his hand to gauge the possibilities of the clouds drifting slowly over the Mauna Lea mountains.
"Mm-hmm."
Young Ian didn't sound thrilled at the prospect, and I glanced at him sympathetically.
"Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in," I quoted.
Young Ian gave me a wry look.
"Aye, that's what I'm afraid of, Auntie."
Jamie, hearing this exchange, glanced back at young Ian and blinked solemnly, his own version of an encouraging wink.
"Dinna be downhearted, Ian. Remember the story of the prodigal son, aye? Your mam will be glad to see you safe back."
Young Ian cast him a glance of profound disillusion.
"If you expect it's the fatted calf that's like to be kilt, Uncle Jamie, you dinna ken my mother so well as you think.
The lad sat gnawing his lower lip for a moment, then drew himself up in the saddle with a deep sigh.
"Best get it over, aye?"
he said. "Will his parents really be hard on him?" I asked, watching young Ian pick his way carefully down the rocky slope. Jamie shrugged.
"Well, they'll forgive him, of course. But he's like to get a rare bollocking and his backside tan before that. I'll be lucky to get off with this scene," he added wryly. "Jenny and Ian are no going to be very pleased with me either, I'm afraid."
He kicked up his mount and started down the slope.
"Come along, Sassenach. Best get it over, aye?"
I wasn't sure what to expect in terms of a reception at Lallybroch, but in the event, it was reassuring. As on all previous arrivals, our presence was heralded by the barking of a miscellaneous swarm of dogs who galloped out of hedge and field and kale yard, yapping first with alarm and then with joy. Young Ian dropped his reins and slid down into the furry sea of welcome, dropping into a crouch to meet the dogs who leapt on him and licked his face. He stood up, smiling, with a half-grown puppy in his arms, which he brought over to show me.
"This is Jorky," he said, holding up the squirming brown and white body. "He's mine. Da gave him to me."
"Nice doggy," I told Jockey, scratching his floppy ears.
The dog barked and squirmed ecstatically, trying to lick me and Ian simultaneously.
"You're getting covered with dog hairs, Ian,"
said a clear, high voice in tones of marked disapproval. Looking up from the dog, I saw a tall, slim girl of 17 or so, rising from her seat by the side of the road.
"Well, you're covered with foxtails, so there," young Ian retorted, swinging about to address the speaker.
The girl tossed a head full of dark brown curls and bent to brush at her skirt, which did indeed sport a number of the bushy grass heads stuck to the homespun fabric.
"Da says you dinna deserve to have a dog," she remarked, "running off and leaving him like you did."
Young Ian's face tightened defensively.
"I did think of taking him," he said, voice cracking slightly, "but I didna think he'd be safe in the city."
He hugged the dog tighter, chin resting between the furry ears.
"He's grown a bit. I suppose he's been eating all right."
"Come to greet us, have you, wee Janet? That's kind."
Jamie's voice spoke pleasantly from behind me, but with a cynical note that made the girl glance up sharply and blush at the sight of him.
"Uncle Jamie? Oh, and..."
Her gaze shifted to me and she ducked her head, blushing more furiously.
"Aye, this is your Auntie Claire."
Jamie's hand was firm under my elbow as he nodded toward the girl.
"Wee Janet wasna born yet last you were here, Sassenach. Your mother will be to home, I expect," he said, addressing Janet.
The girl nodded, wide-eyed, not taking her fascinated gaze from my face. I leaned down from my horse and extended a hand, smiling.
"I'm pleased to meet you," I said.
She stared for a long moment, then suddenly remembered her manners and dropped into a curtsy. She rose and took my hand gingerly, as though afraid it might come off in her grasp. I squeezed hers, and she looked faintly reassured at finding me merely flesh and blood.
"I'm pleased, Mum," she murmured. "Our Mam and Dav very angry, Jane."
Young Ian gently put the puppy on the ground near her feet, breaking her trance. She glanced at her younger brother, her expression of impatience tinged with some sympathy.
"Well, and why wouldn't they be, Clotheed?" she said. "Mam thought you'd maybe met a boar in the wood or been taken by gypsies. She scarcely slept until they found out where you'd gone," she added, frowning at her brother.
Ian pressed his lips tight together, looking down at the ground, but didn't answer. She moved closer and picked disapprovingly at the damp yellow leaves adhering to the sleeves of his coat. Tall as she was, he topped her by a good 6 inches, gangly and raw-boned, next to her trim competence, the resemblance between them limited to the rich darkness of their hair and a fugitive similarity of expression.
"You're a sight, Ian. Have you been sleeping in your clothes? "Well, of course I have," he said impatiently. "What do you think? I ran away with a nightshirt and changed into it every night on the moor."
She gave a brief snort of laughter at this picture, and his expression of annoyance faded a bit.
"Oh, come on then, Gouk," she said, taking pity on him. "Come into the scullery, Weema, and we'll get you brushed and combed before Mam and Da see you."
He glared at her, then turned to look up at me with an expression of mingled bewilderment and annoyance.
"Why in the name of heaven," he demanded, his voice cracking with strain, "does everyone think being clean will help?"
Jamie grinned at him, and dismounting, clapped him on the shoulder, raising a small cloud of dust.
"It canna hurt anything, Ian. Go along wi' you. I think perhaps it's as well if your parents haven't got so many things to deal with all at once, and they'll be wanting to see your auntie first of all."
"Mm-hmm."
With a morose nod of assent, young Ian moved reluctantly off toward the back of the house, towed by his determined sister.
"What have you been eating?"
I heard her say, squinting up at him as they went.
"You've a great smudge of filth all round your mouth."
"It's no filth. It's whiskers,"
he hissed furiously under his breath, with a quick backward glance to see whether Jamie and I had heard this exchange. His sister stopped dead, peering up at him.
"Whiskers,"
she said loudly and incredulously.
"You?
Come on."
Grabbing her by the elbow, he hustled her off through the kale yard gate, his shoulders hunched in self-consciousness. Jamie lowered his head against my thigh, face buried in my skirts. To the casual observer, he might have been occupied in loosening the saddlebags. But the casual observer couldn't have seen his shoulders shaking or felt the vibration of his soundless laughter. "It's all right. They're gone," I said a moment later, gasping for breath myself from the strain of silent mirth. Jamie raised his face, red and breathless from my skirts, and used a fold of the cloth to dab his eyes.
"Whiskers, you?"
he croaked, in imitation of his niece, setting us both off again. He shook his head, gulping for air.
"Christ, she's like her mother. That's just what Jenny said to me, and just that voice when she caught me shaving for the first time. I nearly cut my throat."
He wiped his eyes again on the back of his hand and rubbed a palm tenderly across the thick, soft stubble that coated his own jaws and throat with an auburn haze.
"Do you want to go and shave yourself before we meet Jenny and Ian?" I asked, but he shook his head.
"No,"
he said, smoothing back the hair that had escaped from its lacing.
"Young Ian's right. Being clean won't help."
They must have heard the dogs outside. Both Ian and Jenny were in the sitting room when we came in, she on the sofa knitting woolen stockings, while he stood before the fire in plain brown coat and breeks, warming the backs of his legs. A tray of small cakes with a bottle of home-brewed ale was set out, plainly in readiness for our arrival. It was a very cosy, welcoming scene, and I felt the tiredness of the journey drop away as we entered the room. Ian turned at once as we came in, self-conscious but smiling. But it was Jenny that I looked for. She was looking for me, too. She sat still on the couch, her eyes wide, turned to the door. My first impression was that she was quite different. The second, that she hadn't changed at all. The black curls were still there, thick and lively, but blanched and streaked with a deep, rich silver. The bones, too, were the same. The broad, high cheekbones, strong jaw, and long nose that she shared with Jamie. It was the flickering firelight and the shadows of the gathering afternoon that gave the strange impression of change. One moment, deepening the lines beside her eyes and mouth till she looked like a crone. The next, erasing them with the ruddy glow of girlhood, like a 3D picture in a box of crackerjack. On our first meeting in the brothel, Ian had acted as if I were a ghost. Jenny did much the same now, blinking slightly, her mouth slightly open, but not otherwise changing expression as I crossed the room toward her. Jamie was just behind me, his hand at my elbow. He squeezed it lightly as we reached the sofa, then let go. I felt rather as though I were being presented at court, and resisted the impulse to curtsy.
"But whom, Jenny?" he said.
His hand rested reassuringly on my back. She glanced quickly at her brother, then stared at me again.
"It's you then, Claire?"
Her voice was soft and tentative, familiar, but not the strong voice of the woman I remembered.
"Yes, it's me," I said.
I smiled and reached out my hands to her.
"It's good to see you, Jenny."
She took my hands lightly, then her grip strengthened and she rose to her feet.
"Christ, it is you," she said, a little breathless.
And suddenly the woman I had known was back, dark blue eyes alive and dancing, searching my face with curiosity.
"Well, of course it is," Jamie said gruffly. "Surely Ian told you. Did you think he was lying?"
"You'll scarce have changed," she said, ignoring her brother as she touched my face wonderingly.
"Your hair's a bit lighter, but my God, you look the same."
Her fingers were cool. Her hands smelled of herbs and red currant jam, and the faint hint of ammonia and lanolin from the dyed wool she was knitting. The long-forgotten smell of the wool brought everything back at once. So many memories of the place, and the happiness of the time I had lived here. And my eyes blurred with tears. She saw it, and hugged me hard, her hair smooth and soft against my face. She was much shorter than I, fine-boned and delicate to look at, but still I had the feeling of being enveloped, warmly supported and strongly held as though by someone larger than myself. She released me after a moment and stood back, half laughing.
"Good, you even smell the same," she exclaimed,
and I burst out laughing too. Ian had come up. He leaned down and embraced me gently, brushing his lips against my cheek. He smelt faintly of dried hay and cabbage leaves, with the ghost of peat smoke laid over his own deep, musky scent.
"It's good to see you back again, Claire," he said.
His soft brown eyes smiled at me, and the sense of homecoming deepened. He stood back, a little awkwardly, smiling.
"Will you eat something, maybe?"
He gestured toward the tray on the table.
I hesitated a moment, but Jamie moved toward it with alacrity. "A drop wouldn't have come amiss, Ian, thank you kindly," he said. "You'll have some, Claire."
Glasses were filled, the biscuits passed, and small spoken pleasantries murmured through mouthfuls as we sat down around the fire. Despite the outward cordiality, I was strongly aware of an underlying tension, not all of it to do with my sudden reappearance. Jamie, seated beside me on the oak settle, took no more of a sip of his ale, and the oatcake sat untasted on his knee. I knew he hadn't accepted the refreshments out of hunger, but in order to mask the fact that neither his sister nor his brother-in-law had offered him a welcoming embrace. I caught a quick glance passing between Ian and Jenny, and a longer stare, unreadable, exchanged between Jenny and Jamie. A stranger here in more ways than one. I kept my own eyes cast down, observing under the shelter of my lashes. Jamie sat to my left. I could feel the tiny movement between us as the two stiff fingers of his right hand drummed their small tattoo against his thigh. The conversation, what there was of it, petered out, and the room fell into an uncomfortable silence. Through the faint hissing of the peat fire, I could hear a few distant thumps in the direction of the kitchen, but nothing like the sounds I remembered in this house, of constant activity and bustling movement, feet always pounding on the stair, and the shouts of children and squalling of babies splitting the air in the nursery overhead. "How are all of your children?" I asked Jenny, to break the silence. She started, and I realised that I had inadvertently asked the wrong question.
"Oh, they're well enough," she replied hesitantly. "All very bonny.
And the grandchildren, too," she added, breaking into a sudden smile at the thought of them.
"They've mostly gone to young Jamie's house," Ian put in, answering my real question. "His wife's had a new babe just the week past, so the three girls have gone to help a bit. And Michael's up in Inverness just now to fetch down some things coming from France."
Another glance flicked across the room, this one between Ian and Jamie. I felt the small tilt of Jamie's head and saw Ian's not quite nod in response.
And what in hell was that?